You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
In Hegelian terms, we learn from history that we do not learn from history. Now, 2020 started with so much hope, but there's a confluence of events converging in our current moment in time that give us cause to pause and consider whether we're living through a potentially epoch-defining moment. And I was reading something very interesting by the World Economic Forum the other day, and it was all about a sudden shock upending routine decision-making and forcing leaders to take urgent action. A combination of mistrust, misperception, and fear dissolves the bonds that sustain modern civilization. And it could have been about now, but it was actually 1914, when Europe spent its summer mobilizing for war. And Ronak Gopaldas, director at Signal Risk and a fellow at the Gordon Institute of Business Science, and Bronwyn Williams, economist and foresight lead at Flux Trends, recently penned a very similar piece in the Business Day, writing that there are clear parallels between what we see currently happening in the world and those that preceded the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War in 1989-90. Well, it's great to chat again, both of you. Ronak, kick us off here. Why does it feel like we are at an era-defining inflection point?
The short answer, Michael, is that it seems like we've got the intersection of multiple crises at the moment. As we know, we're in a global pandemic, which has kind of ravaged the world. We've got economic conditions akin to the 1929 depression, which has affected multiple sectors across multiple geographies, both developed market and emerging markets, and shows no sign of letting up. And then you've got political conditions, like we're seeing through the George Floyd protests, anti-racism movements, hyper-nationalism, and a deep sense of polarization around authoritarian and liberal values in the world, which are all coming together at the same time. And if we look back in history, and if we look back at what happened at 1989, that was very similar in the sense that it led to a situation where the center could no longer hold. And then we had a series of rapid changes generationally, ideologically, and geopolitically, which moved the world into a very, very different trajectory. And it does have that sense that we are at this the seminal inflection point right now as well in 2020. It's kind of like a Quentin Tarantino movie in my mind.
It certainly is. Lots of different narratives running through at the same time. Well, Guy Ritchie as well, if that's your thing. Bronwyn, we look at this and we go back to 1989-90, and that was a very important moment. It unleashed a wave of democracy around the world. It unleashed the so-called neoliberal Washington consensus, and arguably a period of great economic prosperity until 2008, of course. And we can, I suppose, quibble as to the cause of the global financial crisis. But is global democracy, though, as an idea, is that under threat right now?
Well, yes, the data would have us believe that. So it definitely is. I think democracy's had its worst year in about a decade in terms of how many countries are now actually just being described as what can be a pure total democracy. So it definitely seems to be a pullback, because back, if you take a trip back in time to around about 1989, 1990, it seemed like the wave of democracy was really unstoppable. Countries across the developing world, across the formerly communist blocs, were all coming around to more democratic ways of governance. What we see now is almost the polar opposite. And I think that both the 1989 turning point and where we are right now comes down to a sense of disillusionment in what was promised to us by these different political systems. So what we saw when the Berlin Wall came down was that communism had not delivered on its promises. There was this difference between the expectation of the system and then the reality. And now what we're seeing is the promises of the neoliberal capitalist agenda, so the sort of global capitalism project, is also starting to not deliver on those expectations that people had of the system. And that's when we get unrest, and that's when we get change. When expectations are less than what is delivered by reality, we get dissatisfaction with the status quo, and we get people demanding some sort of change and some sort of say in the future that's going to benefit them and themselves.
And that's certainly what the hallmarks of the period up until 2020 were all about, Ronak. We had the Brexit vote, we had the rise of Trump and his new nativism, and all of that pushback against the status quo. Just how did we get here to this moment of inflection?
Yeah, so I think we need to again look at the 2008 financial crisis as a key catalyst for all of that. Because what happened then, and Bronwyn's alluded to this, is that in response to that crisis, you had fiscal austerity being propagated as the dominant economic policy with monetary policy easing. So what you had was the dynamic of having asset price inflation, but real incomes and real wages not increasing. And after effectively two decades of prosperity, people got upset and angry that their expectations are not being met. Now, you overlay this with a dysfunctional political system in many countries where the political elites were out of sync with what their electorate wanted. And then the rise and the growth of social media, which gave outsiders the ability to hack the political ladder and has given rise to the rise of these celebrity politicians, Donald Trump, Zelensky in Ukraine, complete outsiders. And you've had this, they've really tapped into the emotional dissatisfaction that has arisen out of that period. We've seen it, like you said, through the election of Trump, through Brexit, which was effectively a rebellion against a broken system. So that is kind of the root cause of how we got here. Now, looking forward, I think what's really going to be interesting is how we reconcile, I think, three big tensions. Now, number one is going to be around the geopolitical and institutional architecture of the world. Are we going to see a period of continued globalization or more insularity, as we're seeing in the West? You know, it's quite ironic that the very architects of the global liberal order, the UK, the US, and the likes, are rejecting this doctrine. In terms of economic systems, you know, in many countries, we're seeing a pivot to the left. Are we going to see helicopter money, magic money, donut economics, these kind of things come to prominence? And then in terms of political system, we're seeing increasing authoritarianism, a rejection of the liberal values that ensued in the period after 1989 and 1990. And how we square these circles is going to be quite critical in defining what the next era looks like, I think.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of that elephant graph that was made popular by Serbian economist Branko Milanovic when he described the effects of globalization as being outsized in terms of their favor towards the developing world over the developed world. And you saw wages rising in the likes of China and elsewhere around the world at a much more rapid rate than you did in the likes of the US and the UK. It was almost a rebalancing of the system. And that's why I think we see such dissent in those particular markets that gave us the global liberal order. But in terms of this shift away from capitalism, Bronwyn, are we seeing a discernible shift away from a system that has, if you look at it, at least delivered the most prosperity for the most number of people? In fact, it's thanks to capitalism that the global population living under the breadline is at the lowest that it's ever been, at under 10%. Yes, inequality may be rising, but there are fewer people in poverty around the world thanks to capitalism. Do you think we're seeing a shift away from this this system of organizing ourselves?
Absolutely. And I think it's quite interesting because, as Ronex alluded to there, we're seeing kind of almost polar opposite trends play out in the formerly democratic Western nations, to use that term, compared to the more totalitarian, more communist regions in the east side of the world. So we're seeing both sides really making compromises to come to the sort of uneasy equilibrium where we've seen capitalist nations starting to dabble with financial socialism, as I like to call it, when you sort of centralize the monetary side of the economy in order to be more redistributive from an economic point of view there. On the other hand, you've got in the Eastern nations, you've got these communist regimes starting to dabble in venture communism, you know, allowing people the opportunity to get rich first. So we kind of see both sides giving concessions, but the new equilibrium does seem to be more away from classic capitalism and free marketeerism. And that's really because the sort of people who are losing out from the globalist neoliberal capitalism sort of setup that we've had over the last couple of decades are quite powerful people. They are disenfranchised people who have had expectations of large prosperity and expectations of continued economic growth. And these sort of voices, particularly your educated cohorts of those populations, are not likely to want to concede ground or to concede in their living standards in order to decrease global inequality. And that is, of course, always the sort of psychological issue when it comes to inequality. We tend to judge our living standards by those around us, rather than those all the way across the world. So the neoliberal globalist policies have been very good at reducing overall inequality between different nations, but they have tended to exacerbate inequalities within nations. And that really gets us to compare ourselves to each other. And that's when resentments and instabilities and social resentment comes to the fore. So yes, to answer your question shortly, I do think that we are moving away from pure capitalism towards more socialist concessions in the former capitalist segments of the world.
And staying on that idea, Bronwyn, would that therefore infer that globalization itself is in retreat?
Yes, that goes hand in hand. So that was always the sort of neoliberal trilemma. You know, do you go with globalization, you've got democracy, and then you've got sort of nationalism, and you've got to kind of pick two. And with neoliberalism, what we picked was growth and capitalism, but on a global scale. And what we sort of traded away from there was national sovereignty. So we're seeing this pushback now towards nationalist values overarching for globalist values. And what all these threads that we've spoken about today really come to together with is that whether you're looking at it from a more extreme sort of economic push towards the left or a more extreme sort of social push towards sort of right-wing values of nationalism, what they have in common is a very populist flavor. And that we're seeing, and that is quite dangerous because that's almost the flip side of what neoliberalism was about. It was about democracy, capitalism, and sort of global peace. And now we're getting the opposite of that, which is nationalism, a slightly more authoritarian tinge, and then a turn away once again from capitalism. And that's quite a precarious place to be in. And unfortunately, history tells us that we tend to push a bit too far in the pendulum with whatever direction we're going in. So we tend to overcompensate for problems and then make worse problems in the other direction.
That is the one thing that we do learn from history as well. Ronak, what comes next, I think, is the big question that so many people are trying to scenario plan or model or forecast, whatever you want to call it. What do you think is going to happen next?
That's a great question, Michael. It's I guess, the million-dollar question at the moment. And I think that's largely going to depend on the type of leadership we get in the aftermath of this pandemic. Are we going to continue to see populist leadership, which tries to kind of short circuit the hard work around the heavy lifting of policy, or are we going to get a shift towards more technocratic leadership? Are we going to see an increased role for China in the world, where China continue to be the champions and the advocates of globalization, or are we going to see a new type of Cold War play out, where you're going to have the China model versus the Western American model as the dominant factor? And you know, that plays out in various capacities, be it technologically, be it institutionally, or be it economically. So you know, I think we're getting set up for a real kind of political moment where countries are going to have to really do some soul searching and some introspection and really pick what a new model looks like. Now, you know, what's quite clear from this conversation is that an optimal solution does not have to be either or. It should be one that integrates the elements that works for countries and that achieves these top-down and bottom-up issues simultaneously. But there are very few countries that are currently doing that. And this is why we're seeing the polarization that we're seeing at present. So I think we're going to continue, at least in the short term, to see this push towards a more authoritarian, more populist agenda. But you know, ultimately, beyond the here and now, we need to have concrete solutions to these problems. Money doesn't grow on trees. Spending in the short term means that money is going to need to be paid back. And you know, leaders, I think, that are able to navigate these dilemmas with complexity, with long-term vision, and with a degree of pragmatism are going to be the most successful ones.
And I think if you want to zoom all the way out and have a look at what this portends for humanity, I mean, Harari in 21 Lessons for the 21st Century writes that the collective intellect and collaboration of countries or state actors is going to be required to overcome some of the big issues like climate change and resource scarcity that are threatening ways of life around the world as well. So it is alarming that the trend is away from that. It's away from globalization and multilateralism. It's more towards unilateralism, if you want to call it that. So it'll be very interesting to see how this does play out and whether we have that leadership that you say is so required. Ronak Opeldas, Director at Signal Risk and Fellow at the Gordon Institute of Business Science, thank you very much. And Bronwyn Williams, Economist and Foresight Lead at Flux Trends. As in 1989, all the factors are indeed lined up for a huge political moment.